All right, you primitive screwheads, listen up.
What an excellent day for an exorcism.
Horror. There is no shortage of monsters to haunt our dreams.
Horror. You got red on you.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Horror.
Alive, it's alive!
Groovy.
Hello, and welcome to Oh, the Horror, a podcast about an expert's look at horror from a casual perspective, I guess you could say. I am your host, Steve Allman.
And I'm Rob Holmes.
And I guess this is the part of the show where we talk about what we do, because this has never been a show before. What are we doing here, Rob?
So we're going to be taking a look at films that I grew up really loving as a child. Like, I've been watching horror films since I was about 12 and kind of just grew up on them. So it's kind of like taking a perspective of someone who's seen all this and introducing somebody who's never seen some of these films before to that.
Which is me.
Yes.
I'm what you could say an enthusiast of horror, but I actually have not seen that many horror movies because I'm what you call a coward. But you've actually begun to open my eyes to a bit more broad scoping things in the horror genre, and I would like to explore those with you. So with the first thing that we get right off the bat here is quite a doozy. The great movie that is Black Christmas.
So I grew up on a lot of horror films, a lot of 80s horror films. This one goes back to 1974 by Bob Clark. This film, it's the original Stranger in the House film, and it was interesting. It had a couple of cool taglines. One of them was, if this movie doesn't make your skin crawl, it's on too tight.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, that's weird.
And he knows when you're sleeping. He knows if you're awake. He knows. It takes place over Christmas break, and there's a group of sorority sisters, and they're about to go home. Some have already left. Some are still there. And they keep getting obscene phone calls. There is this guy that they call, like, the moaner, who keeps calling up and saying some really just normally moans on the phone. In the beginning of this one, just starts going really, really graphic, really over the top, very, very dirty stuff. And it sounds like these girls have heard this stuff before because they
stick on the phone for an alarmingly long amount of time.
Right.
And they, like, just to want to hear what they says. But, like, when I see the reactions on a lot of these sorority girls' faces outside of Margot Robbie or Margot Kidder. Margot Robbie, excuse me. Oh, no.
Margot Kidder. Margot Kidder actually seems like, she even says when she hangs up the phone, she's like, I get three of these a day. Come on. Like,
right.
You know, this is normal. And they're like, I don't know. He seems really, really strange. And in the beginning, during this first phone call, you get multiple voices. You get weird grunting noises, like pig sounding noises. Very, very graphic. And then right at the end, in a normal voice, the thing that really drives it home is the, I'm going to kill you. And then hangs up the phone.
And I'm guessing for 1974, it's a pretty on-the-nose thing to hear in what you know is going to be a horror movie nowadays.
Right,
but
right.
Back then, it was kind of a bit more of a, oh, okay, like serious sort of moment in a horror movie. And I kind of took it as that because I needed to see this movie as for what it was, which was like a movie like this didn't really come around that often.
No, not at all. I mean, this was one of those films. It was the first seasonal slasher film. So before Black Christmas, they hadn't really touched on that. And then afterwards, you ended up getting Halloween, Prom Night, Mother's Day, My Bloody Valentine, Silent Night, Deadly Night, April Fool's Day.
So this started the 70s kickoff of real, like, horror big hitters.
This started that. And it was basically one of the first slasher films, and it was one of the first films that used POV for the killer, and that became a huge thing later in the 80s. Like, people loved using POV for the killer. You have that especially in, like, Friday the 13th, in the beginning of Halloween, and a bunch of other films. It was definitely one of those films that showcased that. Now, it's not the first film that did that, because that would be 1960s Peeping Tom.
Yes. But I'm guessing it's used as a device to kind of hide the identity of the killer while also seemingly revealing what he or she is doing at that time.
Right, and this was done really effectively, too, because a lot of the time when you see it, it's the killer's moving very slowly. The killer's moving very, just kind of lumbering around, or just standing there, or just moving. And sometimes it's not the killer. It's like, oh, gotcha, it's somebody else. It's just this creepy guy who's lurking in the woods and likes to watch people while they're swimming naked and whatever.
Red herring, it was this person.
Exactly. Yeah. But in this one, you start off right in the beginning where this guy is outside of the house. and then crawls up the trellis and is in the attic. So right away, you know this guy is in the house. From the beginning of the film...
Pacing-wise, it's not something that I'm used to.
No, not at all.
Where, like, you expect them to be terrorized a bit more before, like, okay, we're right into it.
Right, but there's other stuff that had already happened. So we find out that a little girl had gone missing, and people were looking for her, and they were going to do a search party. So they're trying to find this girl because they're like, we don't know. She was supposed to come home after school, and she never did. So you're starting to wonder, like, okay, this guy had to have done, he had to have, like, killed her or something. Like, mm-hmm. this, that has to be related to it. And then, you know, they get the obscene phone call. And then the girls end up, one of them, Claire, is like, I'm going to go home, you know, I'm going to get all of my stuff together, guys. I don't want to deal with any of this. Goes upstairs and falls victim to our killer right away, who... we can call Billy because he refers to himself on the phone a lot as Billy. It seems that he had something where he had maybe killed his sister Agnes. He goes from the voice of Agnes to Billy to his mom to the dad to a bunch of other...
It's a weird, like, kind of like psycho-esque sort of, like, turn of, like, character traits.
Like, this guy's a total schizophrenic who escaped from, like, a mental institution and is now just on the attack. And it almost seems like this guy's just come back to his original home. This was a place where he grew up. This was the place where all of this happened. So now he's back. And that's the way it kind of feels as you go through this, as you go through the film.
Right.
Because they try to treat it as a whodunit. Bob Clark's original idea behind it was, you're not exactly sure who the killer is. Could it be this guy? Could it be this guy? We're kind of throwing little hints here and there throughout the entire film. So Claire doesn't meet her dad. Her dad's supposed to pick her up and take her home. So her father comes by the sorority house, meets Mrs. Mack, who is played by Marion Waldman. Mrs. Mack is hilarious in this film.
It's
so great.
It's practically like Mrs. Hannigan, but if all of the orphans loved her.
But it reminds me of Bob Clark's Christmas Story, where characters have their traits. Like, the dad's always going after the turkey. He always wants
the
turkey.
Right, that's their character shtick.
It's like, their shtick, except with her, she has bottles of booze hidden around everywhere. Everywhere.
A horrendously very dangerous alcoholic behavior, but you're it's all you.
But it's done character-driven, and it's very humorous in the way that she does it. So you
it's tongue-in-cheek.
You kind of grow to really like this character in the very short amount of time that you get to know her. And each character is kind of fleshed out pretty well, I would say. So in this film, Olivia Hussey's character Jess is dating this pianist who's in this conservatory, his character Peter, and she has some stuff to tell him. She tells him that she is pregnant right before he has to go do his concert. Or go before the board or whatever for the conservatory, and he just breaks down and goes crazy from that and just goes to his piano and destroys it with a mic stand.
I miss the days where you could just tell your significant other that, you know, I'm pregnant, and that's just like a thing that you say at a Christmas party. Like,
yeah, and it just seems so strange because he just kind of loses his mind. So you're going through the film thinking, this is the guy, this is your killer, he has to be. But stuff just doesn't line up. Like, throughout the movie... you want to think that it's Peter, you want to think that it's Claire's boyfriend, so you want to think that it's him, you want to think it's this person, you want to think it's that person, but at the same time, there's this big feeling of, like, I don't think it's any of these people, I think it's someone completely different.
Well, it's a weird thing, because, again, when you say a slasher movie, you think of a character, you think of something, some borderline inhuman threat
right.
that everybody, at least in the house or the scenario, needs to... escape from, but here it's more of a active questioning thing. It's almost like it's pre-Scream kind of, because like you clearly want to think that the murderer is somebody in the house, because that's how, like, you know, whodunits have been structured for ages. And it's kind of how this movie is structured in a way, because it feels like the movie wants to make you think that it's somebody in the house. There's an interesting, like, little editing point that I saw where, like, the first kill happens and, like, she gets, like, strung up in the shower.
She gets strung up in the closet.
In the closet. Yeah. Excuse me, with the curtain and everything. It confused me.
Yeah.
It cuts to, like, them, exclaiming something because they opened up the...
Right, so
they couldn't possibly hear it because it's a raucous party and everything. So, like, I get that. And it's, like, as that sort of devolves into more and more people getting killed, the editing I found was actually, like... insanely good
oh yeah
for the time, like, really tight.
It's really on point.
It's something that, like, I was shocked at how astutely this movie was made.
Well, it's not even just that. I mean, the innovative camera work, like the scene where the cab driver comes up to the door.
Yeah.
And you see it through the peephole, and just the way it goes from that one shot to that, like, it's amazing. And the POV shots of the killer freaking out in the attic, it's so active, it's so wild, it's so energetic. And for that to be one of the first times that that actually happened in film, that's huge.
And in a lesser movie, if they tried to at least pull off those angles in a different, like, sort of scenario, it wouldn't work, because mm-hmm. those things in by themselves don't really feel like they should, but, like, they all just keep on clicking with the rhythm of how well this movie goes.
Right.
It's a fast movie, actually.
It's pretty fast-paced, but it's different from any of your other normal films, because, okay, yeah, you get your kill right away in the beginning. You get some character development. People are leaving the house. Some people are staying in the house. Billy's not killing people right away. He's kind of taking his time. He gets that first kill done. They find the girl's body who was mm-hmm. in the park.
Right.
And so, I mean, you think that that's Billy. He was out during the day before he got into the house. So you're like, all right, this guy probably escaped from an asylum, killed this girl, got to the house. But they had been getting calls before. They're like, hey, the moaner's calling again. This guy is back, and he's mm-hmm. back on the phone. So I'm thinking, like, he knew where he was going to go. He had already called up there a few times, and now he was there in the house trying to dispatch
her. It's so interesting, because me having only seen it once, like today practically, I was kind of like, I was just sat there watching everything unfold in this movie, and at least at first viewing, it seems like the movie's all over the place. In the fact that, like, things just keep happening, and I don't quite understand what order it's in. But then, like, a friend of mine that had seen this movie before, like, upon second viewing, he picks up a lot as to what more makes sense, because there's only a big reveal at the end, but
right.
kind of a, like, it's a contentious right. ending.
Well, I think what makes this film so scary is that you don't really realize who the killer is. He's never fully identified. Like, so throughout the film, Peter loses his shit when he finds out that she's pregnant, and he destroys his piano, and then goes back to her, like, waits and sits out for a while, and mm-hmm. then and is finally able to talk to Jess. And Jess is like, he's like, I'm gonna marry you, let's do this, let's have this kid and stuff, and I'm throwing it all away. And she's like, oh yeah, no, I'm having an abortion, I don't want a baby, I don't want to marry, you know. And then she's like, I don't want to marry you.
Wow.
And so at that point you're like, well, maybe he is the killer. So they kind of throw that in there where it is that whodunit feel to it.
But it's a weird thing that it almost kind of makes you the detective, because outside of, like, anybody saying that, like,
right.
oh, it could be this person, or it's probably this person, I don't know, like, there's no real, like, finger-pointing moment of, like, this needs to be this, like, outright.
No, they're just trying to figure out what's going on. Now,
yeah.
they don't know anybody has been killed in the house yet. At this point, they don't know that Claire's dead. Mrs. Mack, as she's getting ready to do some stuff, thinks that the cat has somehow gotten into the attic, so she goes up to the attic, and Billy ends up taking a hook that's up there and ramming it through her jaw and then pulling her up into there. So Mrs. Mack is dead, but people think Mrs. Mack has left, because she even said, a cab's coming to get me soon, I'm going to be gone.
Yeah, and then
and
she's just gone.
That's when we have the cab driver scene come up, and he's like, hey, is anybody here? No. So he ends up leaving, and you think Mrs. Mack is gone. So each person is kind of like, yeah, I'm going to be leaving soon for this. Yeah, I'm going to go here. Oh, I was supposed to go here for Christmas, but now I'm not, so I'm going to be sticking around. Mm. As you go through the film, everybody has different plans, and the communication, I mean, this is before cell phones, so the best part about it is that you're only getting it from hearsay through people, or unless someone used a payphone and called the house to tell them, like,
right.
hey, I'll be back. The killer can pick people off whenever he wants to.
I kind of hate now modern day horror movies only because of the contrivances of modern day technology, because
yeah.
there has to be a reason why technology doesn't work.
Yeah.
And outside of it being in a completely different time, it's so difficult to actually get those contrivances right, because outside of the fact that, like, okay, we don't have iPhones anymore, they're just at a hustling, bustling party that, like, people are going in and out, things are happening.
Right.
That happens to have, like, a bunch of murders happen, and, like, it's a kind of amazing thing that, like,
well, it's
things
not even
can just happen there and nobody really notices for a while.
Well, it was one murder during the party, and then most people had started leaving to go do other stuff, and there
yeah.
was the search party going out to try and find this girl. So when you have Margot Kidder's character there, and she's like, I'm gonna go to bed, I'm gonna get some sleep, because mm-hmm. she's gotten really drunk and is talking about,
I love how jaded Margot
yeah, she's
is
talking about
in this
how
movie.
How a tortoise has sex and everything, and a can have sex for like days or whatever, and embarrassing herself in front of Claire's dad and a bunch of other people. Mm-hmm. And they're like, hey, maybe you should go to bed. She loses her shit a bit and she goes to bed. And Billy comes down and he gets that glass unicorn
yeah.
and just stabs the shit out of her.
I wanted to see if I could find some poetry in that kill. I don't know why, because like she has this weird like bad relationship with her parents, seemingly. Like
right.
she's very standoffish about them. Like she doesn't care about them. She kind of like when she was making plans to like go out skiing with her friends on this one
instead
thing,
instead
like,
of going home,
she's just
or
like,
anything,
hey,
yeah.
do you want to do this thing with me? It's gonna be cool, I guess. And like it, like I, it's an alarmingly like. Kind of real performance of how, like, I've seen people at parties.
But I think
like
that's
that.
What makes this movie, I think that's what makes this movie great in general, is that each character is very real. They're dealing with real situations. Like, you have Jess dealing with this pregnancy, you know, you have Peter dealing with his musical conservatory and that not going well because of the news that he gets. You have Chris, who's trying to find Claire, his girlfriend. Like, he's worried about her. And then they go to the police station. They're trying to figure out what's going on. They've talked like, hey, we've gotten obscene phone calls and stuff like that. We need to know what's going on. Are you guys going to help us or not?
Right.
I love the scene where I think it's Margot Kidder's character talks about fellatio to the deputy, I think.
Yeah, that's the funniest thing ever.
Yeah, and they're just like John Saxon's character is just laughing his ass off. There's a lot of real great moments in it, like real great character moments that make you feel for everyone a little more, and it's not the basic contrivances that you get from your 80s slasher films,
because it seems to have the same sort of groundwork that you had have for each potential either victim or the characters in it,
right.
Or like you get a little bit of a characterization of each person of like, okay, what their deal is, what their motivations are, all of mm-hmm. these things. But for some reason it works a lot better in this, because a lot of it actually feels like a lot of these people are just gelling together so well because they've either known somebody, they've known each other for a while, like
right.
there's a preordained history between these people that is that you can feel,
yeah,
that is not exactly told about us. It's just they're just already we've caught them in the middle of them living their lives, and then there just happens to
yeah
be
there's
loose.
No basic introductions of, hey, I'm this character, and
yeah,
this is the
like,
stuff that I'm going through in my life right
now. You don't
right
see so-and-so
now.
Rolling up on a skateboard because he's the edgy one. Or
yeah,
like
these are all just regular people, you know, that it's Christmas time, and with the holidays, you know, a lot of them are going to go home, a lot of them are staying, but you're finding out a lot about their personalities based on what they're doing for the holidays.
Yeah.
But to get back to the character of Billy, one of my favorite horror killers, because you never see Billy's face. You never fully find out who he is. The one thing I will say is that when she's in the house, you know, they decide, okay, the cops are like, we're going to trace these calls. We're going to figure out what the hell is going on. And it's an old school switchboard. So when someone calls and they've
gotten
the call,
plug in the-
they had to plug in the stuff. He's running through hallways trying to track down where it's coming from. They're back and forth on the phone with each other like, okay, no, you got to check here. You got to check here. And they're like, it's at this address. And John Saxon's like, that's the house. It's coming from in the house. So when the deputy guy calls up and Jess answers, Jess is like, wait, what's going on? And he's like, okay, you need to listen to me and do exactly what I tell you. Wait, what? You need to listen to me and just get out of the house now.
Yeah.
The calls are coming from inside the house. So instead she freaks out. Oh, but I've got to check on my friends. I've got to check on Phil and I've got to check on Barb. And so she runs upstairs. And Phil, you know, had been in there because she was like, oh, I'm going to take a nap or whatever. And then she goes in there and Phil's dead. Phil is dead along with Barb, and they're both just...
It's a great moment because, again, we know of this... I know of this conceptually from Scream, but again, of course, that was an homage to that, really.
Right.
I was really, like, again, clearly above and beyond, like, even more so from Scream and the technology that we have today, like, would have never, ever, ever happened today.
Yeah.
Something like this could have never happened today. Even the idea of the call coming from inside the house. Like,
no,
what?
I mean, unless you're, okay, so unless you're, like, in the middle of nowhere and it's landlines and everything like that.
Right.
That could happen. But even, you know, if you have any sort of technology going on in there with, like, the call waiting or the answering machines or, like, the caller ID.
Yes,
if you have caller ID.
ID
or anything like that, you can tell where a call is coming from. And they've done that in other movies where they're like, but it says the call is coming from inside the house. But the way that they play it out and the way it showed the technology at the time and how it had to be done to figure it out really just made it awesome.
It's a bit of a time capsule of the era because it shows so well, like, even if somebody didn't understand how it worked back then, it showed you exactly what their problem was.
Right.
Which is, again, a very smart way of, like, kind of, like, you know, encapsulating the technology of the time.
Right.
And again, this is a smart, smart movie. So let's talk about, like, some of the weird trivia and facts that come with it. Because I don't feel like talking about the ending right off the bat.
Yeah.
Because some of the cool things that were going on with this movie off camera was actually pretty much worth noting. So let's talk about that.
So this film was shot in a total of 40 days, which is not that bad. I mean, it's a small, kind of isolated film.
Mostly just the house, but
mostly just the house, the police station, and like the park scenes and things like that.
Right.
It was interesting because it premiered on NBC during primetime.
Oh, really?
This was after it came out, and it went under the title Stranger in the House, but it was pulled by the network because it was too scary. People were like freaking out because it's, you know, the late 70s, and this film, by the time it had come out then, to NBC. And people were freaking the hell out.
I wouldn't call it overly gory by any means.
It is not overly gory. There's not a lot of gore. There's only 7 kills, technically 8, if we really wanna talk about like the ending.
I only did research about that ending. I didn't even notice that bit until it was told to me.
We'll talk about that in a little
bit. Yeah, okay. We're getting ahead of ourselves there. This is a fun bit.
So it was originally the title for the film was called Stop Me. This was both Elvis Presley's favorite horror film, and Steve Martin has mentioned being a huge fan of it and seeing it like 27 or 28 times or however many. The one thing that really got me about this film that really drove it home was after the reveal that Phil and Barb have been killed, you see this eye from inside the door, like where the door had opened, and you just see this eye staring out at Jess, and like he just starts talking about what'd you do to the baby or Agnes or whatever, and you're just like, holy shit, holy shit. And that's when she's freaking out.
That is a genuinely terrifying, like, because as much as everything that had happened, like just seeing like the eye look out from there, like not even mm-hmm. really knowing who it is yet.
Yeah.
That's insane. And it's not like the trajectory of the killer and like just him, like him relentlessly killing people instead was just like right here. And he wanted to know something. Like getting a sort of motivation directly from one character is really, really crazy.
Right. Now, around 2006.
Okay, so we're talking about this now.
Oh, we are going to talk about
this. Talking about that.
So they remade Black Christmas and they called it Black Xmas.
Now, I thought, like, when I researched this, I actually thought that it was like, oh, so, like, they're calling it Christmas, but it's got the X and it's all, you know, edgy. But no, it's actually Black Xmas.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's Black Christmas, but whatever. It's garbage. Let me just put that out there. So if anybody who's listening to this has a choice of what to watch between Black Christmas Black Xmas, hopefully you guys have already seen Black Christmas if you're listening to this, since we have talked about a lot of spoilers in it.
I hope so that you have as well.
If you haven't, it doesn't even matter because it's that good of a movie that you still need to see it.
Make sure that when you rent or buy or see Black Christmas, the parentheses says 1974 and not 2006.
So the 2006 one was a complete and utter disaster. I think the biggest problem with it was marketing. So what they did with the film, and I was excited because I was like, oh my God, Black Christmas is getting a remake. This is going to be amazing.
Why did you think it would be amazing? Why inherently would that be amazing? Because we just got a remake of My Bloody Valentine back when 3D was getting a hit?
Nope.
No.
The reason was because, so this was 2006. Mm-hmm. The reason I was very excited was because of the trailer. The trailer looked cool as shit. They had it where, like, Lacey Chabert's character is being drawn into what looks like a Thresher, but also, like, what you would have Christmas lights be wrapped up in, but it looks like she's being pulled into something.
Right.
You have people, someone under this ice that's, like, trying to get out.
Right.
You have a lot of stuff. You have the killer on, like, the ceiling kind of hovering up in there, like mm-hmm. he's floating above him. And I'm like, all right, so they're going for a really colorful, more of a mind fuck of a movie. Funny thing, half of that trailer, not in the fucking movie. It wasn't. It was false advertising. It was literally scenes that were filmed just to get butts in seats that never happened in the entire movie.
Mm-hmm. And what did we actually get? Because I've never seen...
We literally got pure garbage. You actually have... So they gave a backstory to Billy, where as a kid, I guess Billy had killed his... It's been a while since I've seen it, and I will never watch it again. Billy killed his parents and made Christmas cookies out of their skin. So he made, you know, punched things with the cookie cutter and then baked some of these cookies and whatever. And Agnes also exists in this film. So it's not one killer, it's two killers. It's Billy and Agnes. And I think Billy is the one who has jaundice or something in it. Like, he has weird yellowish skin. Like, he's sickly or some shit that's going on. It just doesn't... It feels like they were like, all right, let's take the original Black Christmas, try and give it more of a backstory, try and flesh it out, and make them more of these demented psychos who are coming back in to...
Just reap what they sow for...
Right.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of eye scooping. Like, Agnes, both of the characters just like to rip people's eyes out and just scoop eyes out the entire time.
Weird.
So the kills aren't really very innovative. It definitely suffered from the mid-2000s glut of horror remakes that were just subpar in every way possible.
Right, because those were making money and those were like edgy and like Saw was big back then.
Yeah, I mean, they thought they could make a quick buck by doing this and overlaying a ton of CG in it.
Right.
And trying to take, you know, whatever big CW star at the time they had and just throw all of them in there.
It seemed that they almost were going with the philosophy that the studio wanted to go back with in 1974, where they wanted to make things more definite. They wanted story elements to be more concrete, at least in the eyes of the killer. And it was, I mean, we seemingly all know how the 2006 one turned out. Not that great.
I mean, it's pure garbage. There's nothing redeeming. And really, the thing that I get so pissed off about was the false marketing. The false marketing made this movie look like it could have actually been really good. It made it look like you're going to get a lot of really cool stuff going on in it, and instead, you're left with a mess of a film that should not even exist.
No, absolutely not. But moving on from what made that one bad to wrapping up to why this movie actually you think is important. Why is this so great? Like, if you were to sum it all up, what makes Black Christmas a classic? Because why is it endured for so long? Why can you see it on YouTube right now? You could go on YouTube right now and see that this movie in full.
It started the modern slasher genre. Everyone will say that Halloween did, but Halloween was originally proposed to be a sequel for Black Christmas.
Really?
So yeah, John Carpenter and Bob Clark had talked about it, and he was originally going to try and make it kind of as a successor to Black Christmas.
Like a spiritual successor, would you say?
Yeah.
Okay,
and then,
not an actual sequel.
I think there was talks in between of, is this going to be a sequel or is it going to be a spiritual successor?
Uh-huh.
But Halloween definitely got its inspiration from Black Christmas. So without Black Christmas, we wouldn't have Halloween. We wouldn't have all of these other horror movies. We wouldn't have any of the seasonal slasher films, and we wouldn't have a lot of this POV stuff. I mean, when you think about it, this is 1974. The last time that they had done POV was 1960. So we're talking a 14-year difference for horror films using this point of view filmmaking.
Mm-hmm. And it was a bit more of an artsy technique back then. It's not. It was not exactly done. Now, at least, it's seemingly very campy and like...
I mean, this was
but
like
now
pure.
It was kind of cutting edge.
This was pure psychological terror. Well,
yeah.
A lot of the time, it's trite now because I don't think these filmmakers know what they're doing when they get behind these cameras and they're like, "I'm just going to make a POV. Okay, we're moving through the woods and we're doing
like
this."
Oh, it's like Evil Dead.
Evil Dead was fantastic because that was its own.
Right.
Sam Raimi did like his Sammo Cam, and he took a lot of techniques that hadn't been done, like, hey, I'm going to strap a camera to a 2x4 and have the camera
ride on a motorcycle,
run through, you know, the woods and go a motorcycle and all this other shit. And that's what made that amazing, because it was innovative camera technology or camera tricks that they were doing. Mm-hmm. But for Albert J. Dunk to really get in there and basically portray the character of Billy, it was just awesome. Like, the way he moved around with it, the way the camera was positioned on him, the fact that you're watching this character freak out so much and really just have these temper tantrums. And then, you know, the voices, like how there were so many voices on the phone.
It's weird, like how, like, visceral and, like, just kind of crazy it
and
was.
Part of me wonders, like, was some of this pre-recorded stuff that he had? Because these voices overlapped so much. It seemed like...
Right, yeah. It's like you can easily overhear two people talking
perfectly. Three, four, like... And when they filmed this, they did use three different voices that were going in.
But it's all one person. Like, in the canon, in the movie.
In the film, yeah, it's all one person. So you know it's this person who has definitely a split personality disorder, which is why I think it worked so well that you really start to think it's Peter at certain moments, because you're watching Peter go through a psychological breakdown, especially when he destroys his piano.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's where this film, I think, does stuff that a lot of other movies don't. It's like, oh, I think it's this guy. Well, they've wound up dead. Oh, I think it's this guy. Well, now they're dead.
And that's an interesting thing. There isn't a process of elimination sort of thing here. It starts off as an ominous thing of, like, the killer is somebody who we don't know, and then it starts to be like, maybe it is somebody we know, rather than, who is it?
Yeah.
It's not like the game of Clue.
Right.
Like, we're like, someone in the house has the candlestick. Like,
well, and what's also cool is you never see the character of Phyllis die.
No.
Andrea Martin's character, you know that she's in the house, you know that she's there, you never see her die. And then when you find out that she's dead, you're like, well, I guess Billy's been to work, you know,
that's going
in there and getting what he needed to get done. But it's he's methodical. He's not just like, hey, I'm in the house, I'm chasing you all around. He takes his time. I mean, this is a real psychopath, really, how not to get caught. The fact that Claire's body is up by this window on the third floor and no one ever sees it and just rocking in this chair back and forth.
That kind of stuff, that creative amount of thinking is, again, the kind of things where I'm just like, man, somebody had to write this. That's
and there was a lot of stuff going back and back and forth between, you know, the writer and the director. Like, there was a lot of changes that they decided to make throughout. So it was definitely a lot of collaboration going on in it. And I think it just turned out to be an amazing film.
I would agree, and I would also like to add the fact that you see so many early things of what made slasher movies or horror movies that we take for granted now great then. I keep seeing a couple of things that have been regurgitated in throughout, like, the visual language of horror movies now that clearly either stemmed from this or brought this into the light that made it so good. And it works so well here, even for a movie that clearly shows its age, but in every good way that it can. Like, it's a time capsule in a good way, and it shows its age to make it a positive. That's kind of incredible that a movie can stick around like that and be a cult classic. I really am surprised that not that many people have seen this movie before. I'm surprised I have not at least been exposed to it culturally as much as everybody else has.
It holds up so well. I mean, the fact that you have all of these different storylines going on, it's not just, hey, we're trapped in a house. It's... Oh, man. I cannot say enough good things about
this
film.
It's great. I think it's actually great, and I was very wary about a movie being... I don't know. I had been biased because a movie had been that old and not knowing how effective it could be as a slasher movie pre-Halloween.
Oh, you have no idea how long it took me. You have no idea how long it took me to watch this, because I had been told... So I think I was probably like 14 or 15, and one of my buddy's moms was like, this is the scariest thing. And I'm like, wait... So I'm watching like Dead Alive at the time, and I'm watching like Return of the Living Dead and like Lucio Fulci's Zombies. So I'm definitely in my gore kick at that point and very heavy splatter horror. And that was the stuff that I really loved. And she's like, no, I'm telling you, you have to see Black Christmas. This is one of the scariest movies you will ever see. Thank you. Thank you, Mrs. Rosenblum, for making me see this film, because holy crap, was it amazing.
It's great. I would like to thank her as well, and I'd like to thank you, Rob, and I'd like to thank the people listening for having us talk about this crazy good movie. Please check out Black Christmas. We absolutely love it. We agreed on this one.
We talk about these films, and I pick out a list of films. So what we do, if you guys don't already know, is... So I've made a list of a lot of films that I personally enjoy, and I keep adding the list all the time. They're different. Some are gory, some are psychological thrillers, some are like your slasher films, some are supernatural, this, that, and the other. vampires, werewolves, zombies.
You name it.
We cover it. But I try to pick stuff that is the best of the best. I don't always want to pick the ones that everybody knows mm-hmm. right off the bat. But I think that some of the stuff that we've touched on so far, and some of the stuff that we will touch on, you guys will know. But we're going to go really in-depth on a few of those. I know in an upcoming episode, just so you guys know, for Friday, January 13th, we will be covering the Friday the 13th franchise.
Oh, boy.
We will only be covering the ones from the 1980s, though.
I like how you established that rule. Thank you for establishing that rule. So that's going to save me a lot of time and sanity.
Now, let's put it this way. They're not all good.
No.
They really aren't. There's some that I really love that a lot of people hate. I have reasons for why I really enjoy them. That one will be longer than our normal podcast, just so you guys know. That'll probably run maybe an hour to an hour and a half.
But we'll go very in-depth.
We'll go through the order of them. We'll go through a little bit of the history and everything like that. So we hope you enjoyed this, and we hope you stick around so you can hear the next one.
Thank you guys very much. I have been Steve Allman.
And I'm still Rob Holmes.
Still, and we love it. Aww. Thank you guys so much for listening, and we will see you guys next time.
On Oh the Horror.
Horror. Look at me, Damien. It's all for you.
Horror. Come, it is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
Horror. When there's no more room in hell, the dead will walk here.